when I transitioned away from the cocktail, I wanted to do kind of a re-intro and talk about who you are to me a little bit, and then use that to kind of springboard into some other conversations. We've covered a lot of what I would hope to talk about already, but I, in kind of preparing for this, I did a little bit of digging. Wow. And I just wanted to see, what could I find?
Oh.
So, I'll say that, you know, there's no dirt out there or anything like that. You know, but I,
my life's an open book.
Right. Yeah. And certainly, there's nothing that goes back 30 years because, you know, the social media and,
right.
And you know, things like YouTube didn't exist 30 years ago. But I did find something here, and I just, in the vein of kind of introduction and, you know, who Greg is to me and what he's inspired in my life, I wanted to see if I could play this for you. And, right now I'm looking for a date and I'm not able to spot it instantly, but I'm just going to play it and you will probably remember when this was. And what it was about.
I teach all my students how to find their passion. When they find their passion, I always tell them that if they can make a living doing their passion, they're never going to have to work a day in their life. With all the turmoil that's been happening around the world in the last couple of years, my favorite moment has just been a week ago when the students were learning a piece called Infinite Hope. And when I was on the podium and the students were performing, I could feel the emotion coming from the students, and I could also see it in their faces as they were playing. And when they got done playing the piece, you could feel the energy in the air, and there was not a dry eye in the auditorium. It was an amazing moment.
So there's more, and maybe we can edit some of that into the final cut, but that. And I'll go back, and I don't know if I'll be able to quickly find it again.
Happening around the world in the last couple of years, tell them that if they can make a living doing their passion, they're never going to have to work a day in their life.
That right there. So that's what this podcast was about. When I thought about why I wanted to do this podcast, it was because I wanted to talk to people who made their passion their life, who took their passion and found a way to make a career out of it, and make it the thing that they're doing in life. And I think so many of us have a passion for things like music, and then we go from there to, the jobs and the careers, and I don't want to say it's a shame, but it I think sometimes we lose touch with that passion. And again, this podcast for me was about finding the people who've made their passion their life, and just learning from them, hearing from them. And so when I found that little nugget on YouTube, and I'm sure you remember what that interview was for, it just really struck me. And I thought, that's why I'm doing this. That's why I'm having this podcast.
So that interview was from the Fox Chamber Chamber of Commerce, mm-hmm. and I had won Teacher of the Year for the entire Fox City area, mm-hmm. and it was interesting because I had been nominated, and I'd been nominated for different things in the past, mm-hmm. so how much you put into it, you know, how much,
sure, yeah, right,
you know. And so I got nominated, and then all of a sudden I got this letter in the mail saying, like, you're one of the top three and we need you to come in and do an interview. And so I showed it to my wife and I said, you know, should I take this seriously? Is it something I should really do? And so then she looked it up and she went, wow, this is a big deal. You should probably go do this. So,
wives are good for stuff like that.
Yeah, you know, because it was, you know, she looked it up and she did the homework, And she said, yeah, this is like a big, big deal. And then I got there, and you know, so they had asked if I would put together a combo because they needed some music during the event. It was a beautiful, beautiful, you know, black tie event in downtown Appleton. And so I was honored just to be nominated, and then they asked if I would put a combo together, a jazz combo together, to perform at the event. So I asked my students to come and perform. And so we put a jazz combo together, and we're doing our thing. And the students got to stay around for the meal, and I said, "Well, you guys can head out if you want." And they said, "No, no, no, we want to stay here. We want to be part of this." And they started doing all the awards, and you know, top teacher of you know science, top teacher this and that. And they said, and then we've got real quick story is there were three of us that were the being nominated that had made it to the final of teacher of the year.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was one of my old students.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. And so
okay,
all of a sudden they announced who the teacher of the year award was, and it was myself, and I was flabbergasted. I was shocked, but it was quite a moment. It was beautiful.
And you had your own cheering section.
I did. I had half my band there. My combo there. It was cool.
Yeah.
The administrators, neat. You know, were very supportive. They came out from Hortonville also, and it was very nice.
Yeah, that's very good. So what year was that? Do you remember?
That was just last year.
Just so 2022?
Yeah.
So would that have been like spring of?
Yeah, because it was. I had already announced my retirement,
mm-hmm.
and so this was April, I believe, 2022. So when this year's Teacher of the Year came through, I was asked to go to the Fox Cities Chamber of Commerce and help decide who were going to be the teachers this year,
mm-hmm.
which was really an honor also because sure. there's so many good teachers in the Fox Valley area. And to have to go through all of those, it was painstaking. You know,
another award.
Having to go through all of these nominations, but it was really cool to see how many wonderful teachers there are out in the area. So it was a part of the process, having to go through the selecting committee for it the following year.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was such a huge eye opener to see how many amazing teachers are in this area. So it was another beautiful moment. You know, you always take every single moment you have. My mother died really young of cancer at 49. And I was a sophomore in college. And when she passed away, before she passed away, she was staying at my place and because it was closer to the hospital in Green Bay. I was going to St. Norbert at the time. And I remember she got angry because whenever the grandkids would come over, she would always get down on the floor and play with the grandkids. And mm-hmm. she was always playing with the grandkids, you know, because parents are so busy, right?
Sure, yeah.
And so she pounded her fist on the sofa cushion and she said, "Who's going to take care of the kids?" You know, and tears started rolling up in my eye. I said, "I will." You know, and we found out, when she found out she had cancer, she started chemo right away, and 3 months later she had passed away. So, you know, at that time, I was a sophomore in college, and I was a cocky little kid, you know, thinking that, you know, life on the edge, you know, because you're in college and all that kind of stuff. And that was the first time where I went, you know, I need to dedicate my life to kids and mm-hmm. to give back. And my mom's right. Who's going to take care of the kids? And if we don't, nobody else is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to. There's so many kids that need extra help in your community. There's so many people that just need that extra hug every now and then. And there's so many people that are sponges, and they just need that extra person right. to come in yeah. and say, "Hey, let's do this."
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, that's. I've actually heard you tell that story before, and I just. Who's going to take care of the kids? Just, you know, simple, profound statement,
right?
That strikes a chord in a moment, and how many years later it's still having an impact.
Huge. Yeah. You know, it changed my life literally, because you know, when my mother died, I was angry. I was angry at mm-hmm. God. I was angry at the world. I was, you know, you got this, like, you know, this pillar of our family who passes away. And then how can this happen, you know? And mm-hmm. then years later, when you realize what that impact meant, it made me a better teacher, made me a better parent, a much better parent, because it made me realize that every moment is irreplaceable. Mm-hmm. You don't give up any moment with your child. The things that we have now are very precious, and they're worth more weight than gold. So take care of your kids, take care of the time that you've got with them, because you only get one chance at it.
So I'm going to tell a little bit of a story that I'll probably edit out later. But the when we were trying to get I was trying to get ready. I was under the gun here because I was not prepared for Greg today. And I was really struggling to get everything ready. I was in a kind of a frantic, and stuff wasn't working. And Greg was here, and Meredith was great, and she was kind of keeping you busy. But, you know, I running around, and my 8-year-old was having a meltdown. And you didn't know this was happening because you were kind of outside and enjoying the weather and the patio. And so he was having a meltdown, and I just stopped what I was doing, and I just picked him up, and I set him in my lap, and I gave him a hug, and I just sat there with him. I don't know what was going on. I have no idea, but he needed a hug.
Yep.
And so I just gave him a hug, and I said, "Buddy, I don't know what's happening, but Daddy loves you. Whatever it is, you know, it's going to be all right, you know." And I just spent a few minutes doing that,
right,
in the midst of the chaos of trying to get the show up and running. And so I don't, you probably didn't even know that was happening.
You know, and no matter how old you are, we all need those moments, right? You know, we've all gone through COVID. We've all gone through all those bad times in your life. And that's why also you need a heart when you're a teacher going into a classroom, because you don't know what those kids are going through. You don't know what's going on at home. You know, sometimes a grandparent is ailing, or a parent is ailing, or something's happening, and you're supposed to teach math, or you're supposed to teach English, or you're supposed to teach music, and the child can't focus on what you're trying to teach, and then you get mad because they're not focusing on what you're trying to teach when there's something happening outside their life. So instead, you need to go, you know, maybe bring them over after the class and go, "I notice your focus is off, so how can I help?" You know, don't yell at them. Don't get angry and, you know, give them a detention because they weren't focusing.
Right,
you go, "How can I help? You know, let's talk about this."
So in a lot of the roles that I've had in my career, I've had the opportunity to lead people. I've not been a teacher per se, but I've been a leader, a mentor. And the phrase that comes to mind for me is seek to understand, because people will act out. Maybe they've had a bad day. Maybe they're really struggling through something, and that might manifest in a certain interaction that is unexpected, or it might even be that, you know, an ongoing thing that leads to ongoing behaviors,
right,
that you don't have the complete picture to. And if you sort of make a judgment based on those interactions, you've probably left out bits of the story. And so seek to understand is the phrase that I often use for myself and for others to encourage this idea of a dialogue. So go have that conversation, the one you were just talking about, where you maybe you take them aside, you're one-on-one, and you try to find out what's going on. And maybe there's nothing you can do about it. But the fact that you took the time to listen a lot of times makes a big impact.
That is something to do about it. I mean, just the listening is a huge... Yeah.
And I think about it too with you know, in terms of raising kids, and my kids will come home and they'll have stories about this kid that did this thing at school. And a lot of times it's a recurring thing. There's
right.
this kid. And I always encourage my kids to imagine what his home life might be like,
mm-hmm.
that creates this personality of kind of, you know, outbursts. And, you know, there's something behind you know, that. And all I'm really hoping is that they engage that kid with some compassion.
Because quite often, and this is not just students in the classroom, this is in your workplace, this is everywhere. You've got people who maybe come from real stable families, they come from real stable environments, and then we put this persona that everybody's in that same boat. You know, we all have a house with a 2-car garage and a, you know, a car inside of it and maybe a boat. You know, we all have this persona that we're all the same. And we don't realize that some of the kids in these classrooms and some of the people that you work with maybe don't get to go home to a home that you're used to.
Mm-hmm.
I had a student one time in Lower Michigan who never wanted to go home after school, and I thought, you know, this is strange, you know. So he was helping me organize music one day, and I said, you know, it's getting late, it's starting to get dark out, let me give you a ride home. So I gave him a ride home, and my eyes were wide open because I dropped him off, and the house was so dilapidated, I didn't think anybody would ever be living in there.
Mm. Wow.
And so I dropped him off, and I, you know, my heart sunk, and I went, how can I drop him off here? I don't think mm-hmm. it's safe. And he's lived there all his life.
Right.
You know, so it's, you never know. You have no clue. So you should never assume that everybody is coming from the same background. Even, you know, the political things that we're running into these days, I don't assume to know what the other side is thinking. And hopefully I can try to put myself in that realm a little bit once in a while so that I can just try to feel both sides,
right,
as opposed to constantly thinking one side or the other. Because, you know,
yep.
Where's all the middle people? Where are all the people that I grew up with that were going down the middle going, you know, we got to work together. You know, what happened to those people? You know?
Yeah, so I don't want to spend a lot of time on politics. But,
right, me neither.
One of the things that I always kind of aspire to or think about in politics is kind of that the duality of our country. I've often thought that we needed a third party so that no one party had control, and that there was a requirement to collaborate. Like, you couldn't get anything done unless you collaborated. But I will say that I genuinely believe that we need both perspectives, given that we have this sort of,
you know, in an ideal world, there's supposed to be checks and balances, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you bring up any topic, and it's supposed to be with as many congressmen and as many senators that are out there, there's supposed to be all of this, well, yeah, that's going to help my state, that's going to help my people, that's going to help the people I'm working with.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's always supposed to be this checks and balances. That's the way government is supposed to work. That's the way our government is supposed to work, where you don't have just one person running the shot. But when all of a sudden the politicians say, well, I have to go with my party's decision or otherwise I'm going to get kicked out,
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden you no longer have people that are looking at the issues. They're looking at their parties.
Right, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. and that's the saddest thing. But anyway, let's get
on
to politics.
Yeah, so one more thought on this and we'll move on.
Yeah.
Who knows if any of this will actually make the final cut, but
who knows? It might be stuck in the Smithsonian in 20 years. The best interview ever.
That's pretty aspirational.
Oh.
So the one of my favorite stories from politics is the fact that Abraham Lincoln, when he was elected, put members of both parties in his cabinet because he wanted to hear multiple perspectives. And I've always thought, if I ever had the opportunity to go into politics and be able to make those kind of decisions, that I would aspire to kind of make the same types of choices. I want multiple perspectives. I want somebody who's going to disagree with me.
Right.
And then tell me why, so that I can, in the end, between the combination of those ideas, come up with the best and, you know, greatest good. And I do think that's why we need multiple perspectives. But you're right, there's so much, you know, kind of towing the party line that,
you know, being a musician, I was always told you don't have to be the best musician in the band. You just have to surround yourself with geniuses, right?
Sure. Yeah.
You know, and Thomas Edison did the same thing. He wasn't the best inventor in the world. He surrounded himself with geniuses. He had Menlo Park.
Right.
And they sat down and they said, we want this many major inventions per week or per month or whatever it was, and we want this many minor inventions. And they took the best minds and they said, okay, everything's on the table. You know, we're not going to wipe stuff off the table. We're going to put everything on the table. We're going to figure out what works, what doesn't. And so they started coming up with inventions and beautiful, wonderful ideas, you know, things that we had never thought of before. He was best friends with Henry Ford. Now we've got automobiles and all this kind of stuff that didn't exist before, right? So the Menlo Park was a fantastic place because they brought all the minds in. They said, let's create. Let's do something new. Let's do something that's never been done before. Let's make the world a better place, right? Phonograph, the everything, right? And so why don't we have a political system that is exactly the same? The president of the United States does not need to be the smartest person in the world. They need to be smart enough to hire the smartest people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want the person that is doing the finances, the person that is running the stock exchange, the person that is really running money in my world to be the smartest accountant or the smartest, you know, they need to be a genius when it comes to money, right? I want the person who's running the schools to be the smartest genius that knows about education at all realms for every person, you know, no matter where you're coming from. I want the person that's in charge of transportation to be the absolute genius in education, not just some guy that I know that drives a car. You know, put these geniuses in the right spots in the cabinets as opposed to friends from my party. Because when you're doing that, when you're looking at family members or when you're looking, are you really creating the best think tank? You know, they used to call them think tanks.
Right.
Because it was who's going to really produce the best. You know, I don't know that our past president or our current president is the best at being a president. What we need is a president that says, you know, I'm just going to put people in the right places. As a band director, I wasn't the band. The band wasn't, I wasn't playing those instruments.
Right.
I needed to put the right people in the right spots. And when I didn't have the best, I needed to teach them to be the best. And I needed to give them the creative resources to become the best so that my band would be the best.
Yeah,
so that's the same thing for a political leader. They want their country to be the best. Put the right people in the right spots, and maybe that'll happen.
So I've just got an observation to make. I think I said once to a CEO for a company that I worked with that I think you have to be a narcissist to be a CEO. And then I got a look from him that I thought, ooh, that was probably not the right thing to say. but my point was that in order to take on a role of leadership, and in this context, the president of the United States, that there's an element of like uber confidence that you have to have. And I think that a lot of times manifests as narcissism. And what you just described takes a lot of humility.
Right.
If you're going to say, you know, and it's not about me, it's about all of you. That takes a lot of humility. And I just think it's hard to put those two things together. The confidence to take on a role like a president or a CEO, yet the humility to make it about the people you surround yourself.
You know, do you want Einstein running your country or do you want Einstein running your science department?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I would pray that someday we'll have political leaders who are more directors as opposed to feeling like they can actually do the job.
Mm-hmm.
When you've got a teacher that knows that these kids are going to go off and be everything, you know, most of my kids aren't going into music, but I'm going to instill a love for music and also instill a love for education. So if they go into science, if they go into math, if they go into English, it shouldn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm instilling a love of education and a love of knowledge. not just a love of music. And so hopefully every single one of my students walked out the door a better person than when they came in.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's if anybody listening kind of takes anything away from our conversation, it's, you know, there's a lot of nuggets in here for what it means to be an educator, a teacher. And that might be in a classroom. It could be as a parent. It might be as a leader or a mentor in an organization. You know, but the idea that you're trying to get the best out of somebody or help them achieve their best, but at a minimum, grow.
Right.
Leave here better than they were when they came. So I'd like to maybe, I don't know, I lost the camera.
Uh-oh.
And I know that's because the battery went down. And so we're no longer going to get the wide shot for the rest of this episode. But fortunately, we have Greg, and we have me, and then we have Greg and me. So we should be able to pull this off. I think I've got full batteries in the other two, so we should have plenty of buffer here. But there were a couple of things that I wanted to just kind of hear the story on. We got a little bit of it a while ago, but one of the things that I've always kind of been fascinated by was this journey that you took that started in the Midwest as a, you know, music educator, and then landed you in Hawaii on a trip, but then turned into what to me was a lifelong passion for the Hawaiian culture. And I suspect there are those in Hawaii who would consider you an honorary Hawaiian. And, you know, because you just really exude that culture and you're very sincere about that. And it's led to now a sort of semi-retirement gig or career as a tour guide in Hawaii. And so you make regular trips to the state to take people on tours and show them the state, I think in a way that only a native could. And so that's always been very interesting to me. And something I've been curious about, like what was the sequence of events that led to this really true passion for that culture, and one that shows up in so many different areas, including your ukulele efforts with Forte and the Pianissimo, but also in the has band with some of the stories that you tell when we're when we have shows. But so tell me a little bit about, you know, that history.
All right, so a long story longer. So in 2001, because of 9/11, we went to Hawaii for the first time. And so that was the first time that I had embraced the Hawaiian culture. I had never been to Hawaii before. And so I took the students over, and it was a life-changing moment, because not only did they do it on a shoestring, because like I said, we had lost a lot of our money by a trip that we were supposed to take to Europe. But when we got there and we were so embraced, you know, the Hawaiians were calling us cousins, you know, we were part of their family. And I took that to heart. I took it as they are sincere. They're not mm-hmm. just doing this as a means of touring. You know, they want to embrace their culture. And the Hawaiians that have become my friends and part of my family, they have really taken me in and said, this is who we are. We want you to be part of our family. You know, we love your presence. We love your sense of spirit, and we believe that you have the aloha spirit. So I started working with them, and I say work, but it's one of those things where, you know, you're talking passion. It doesn't feel like work. I help groups go because I think it's important. I think that groups should be going and experiencing this aloha spirit. And so I'm doing that a lot now. But also, there's one of the things that all of the musical groups do is perform at Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor is a gem. It's sitting out in the Pacific mm-hmm. Ocean. And I don't know if you know this or not, the history of what happened with the USS Arizona,
mm-hmm.
the men that were on the USS Arizona, the ships that were in port, had a competition, and it was a music competition,
mm-hmm.
and they took second. And so because they took second place, the USS Arizona, they were allowed to sleep in until 8 o'clock. Normally, Reveille was at 7 o'clock.
Right, yeah.
The bombing of the Pearl Harbor started at 7:56. So they were still in their bunks.
Mm-hmm.
And when they took that shell through the ship that took it down, it was very instantaneous.
Right,
and
right.
That's why all of those men are still down at the bottom of Pearl Harbor. And so if you've ever been there, it's moving.
I have been there, yeah.
They show you this video before you go out to the memorial, and they show you actual footage of what it was like there at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go out to the memorial, and you still see the oil coming up from the ship, and they call that the Tears of the Dead. And you take your lei that was given to you on the first day when you show up in Hawaii, that beautiful fresh flower lei with the orchids and the plumeras on it, and you take that out there with you, and you cut the string, and then you slide the petals into the water as a gift mm-hmm. to those people that are there. And it's extremely moving. Now, who shouldn't experience that? You know, every American, yeah. everybody in the world should experience that feeling, and giving back to the people who have sacrificed their lives for our country. That's the greatest gift. And mm-hmm. going there and feeling that emotional bondage of giving something back is something that everybody should do, whether you're in a band, a choir, orchestra, or just anybody. You need to have those kinds of experiences to really appreciate why we have the freedom that we have in our country. And so the other thing that I found out through the years is that Pearl Harbor was not, the entire Hawaiian Islands weren't originally part of the United States. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were taking care of themselves just fine right. until yeah. We came over and we said we want to make this part of our state, and we want to make this part of the United States. And they basically took over the Hawaiian Islands by putting the royalty into house arrest. Queen Iolani was in house arrest in the palace. It's the only palace that's still on U.S. soil, and you get to go tour that. She made this beautiful quilt, peace quilt, showing the whole history of everything that happened when you take that tour. The people really lost their islands because we came in and took them. Now, I learned this not because they wanted me to learn it. I learned it because I started studying the history. I started going to the palace and reading everything I could.
Sure.
And when I started learning all of this, I went, wow, what a humble culture. You know, there are still some Hawaiians that are mad about the whole situation and, mm-hmm. you know, wish they could just have their islands back. And there are others that are saying, you know, it happened for a reason. But when I'm there as this haole, as this white guy coming in and playing the ukulele and singing in the Hawaiian language and talking to the students and talking to the people that come to Hawaii, I can talk from an outsider's viewpoint saying, we need to show these Hawaiian people our respect for their culture and who they are, because we are guests on their islands. I don't care if it's a state or not.
Mm-hmm.
We are guests on their islands, the islands that they turned into something. These are their lands, and we are guests. Even if we do have military bases and everything over there, we are really guests on the island. And so when I say these kinds of things to the people that are coming to the island as an outsider, because a lot of the Hawaiians won't say this because they're too humble.
Mm-hmm.
Their culture doesn't, you know, if they were saying it, it'd be like they're whining, right?
Sure.
But if I say it, they're getting their word out. And the people can really look at it and go, oh yeah, this is almost like a foreign country. And it feels like a foreign country yet it's part of the United States. So they've got this little oxymoron of oh my God, we get, you know, it's part of the United States, but it's, why is it so different? And so when they really understand the culture and the people, and the people are so loving, they're going to embrace you in. That's who they are. They're going to embrace you into their culture. They're going to embrace you into the islands, and they're going to say, come and enjoy, you know, please take care of it. You know, this is land. This is, we don't own this land. This is God's land. This is everybody's land. And so that's part of who they are. So when we go there for our students and for everybody to understand before they leave that we are on this earth for a very minute amount of time, we need to leave it better than when we got here. And so that's their philosophy. And so we should always embrace that. You know, this is a beautiful, beautiful planet, and some people take care of it and some people don't. I love the Hawaiian culture because they do take care of it, and they take care of their people and they take care of us. And so I became embraced because I love the culture and who they are. And because of that, and I can provide a service for Hawaii, they call me up and they go, we want you to come and help us out with the groups that are coming over because you understand us. If we say it, we sound like we're whining. If you say it, you do it with respect.
So you answered part of my question. And the part that you answered was like what experience did you have in Hawaii? And it sounds like it was on that first trip that sort of spark ignited that experience that wanted you to go back, that made you so passionate about the culture and turned you into an ambassador of that culture. And that was that it was life-changing for you. The experience that you had, the way that they welcomed you in, took a situation that was in essence a disaster for the group. All this money that had been spent on a trip to Europe that had to be canceled, and now what do we do? And they said, we'll help you. And then you went there and you got to absorb more of that culture. And so there was clearly an imprint on you as you went through that first experience. And then that led to, I've got to come back and I've got to bring more people. Talk me a little bit through just the connections that you made, though, that turned this into an opportunity for you to take people on tours and turn that into a kind of a semi-retirement lifestyle.
So I think the biggest was David Millwood, who owns the company, who's a best friend of mine. I met him many, many years ago in Chicago. And he was talking to band directors about coming over and, you know, make it happen. And that first trip, you know, we were already on a shoestring budget. And we get over there, and he sent us an itinerary. And this is the itinerary we're going to follow. But, you know, we always know itineraries are fluid. And especially because it's on a shoestring budget, you never know what's going to happen. So we took quite a few people. We had like 180 people on this trip, when we get over there, and he comes up to me and he goes, we've got to do a change. He said, we have a problem with Hanama Bay. Hanama Bay is a beautiful state park and they have snorkeling there. It used to be a volcano, you know, so it's now a volcano that is extinct. Mm-hmm. And it's gone down so far that the ocean is actually into it. So there's beautiful coral in there. So there's where you're snorkeling, it's safe because you don't have the big waves and everything. It's a beautiful place to snorkel.
Yep.
And it's got all the fish and everything. It's just gorgeous, gorgeous. And so right before we got there, the state said, we need to limit the amount of people that can come here. So we're not going to allow big buses anymore. So we're not going to allow big groups. And this was just right before we got there. And David already signed us up that this was part of what we were going to be doing. So he comes to me and he goes, we can't go snorkeling in Hanama Bay. And I said, okay. So I tell the group. Well, some of the group started complaining. It wasn't the kids. Okay. The kids were going with the flow, right?
Sure.
But some of the adults were like, you promised us an Ama Bay. You said you were, and I'm going, come on, you know, give him a break, you know?
Right, yeah.
And so he goes, okay, just give me a minute. Just give me a few minutes. Let me check on something. So he comes back and he goes, okay, this is what we're going to do. I'm renting 6 ducks, you know, like the ducks that they have at the Wisconsin Dells.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I'm renting 6 ducks and we're going to put people out on 6 different tours. And you're going to go out on, you know, so I want you to split up the group into smaller groups. And you're going to go out in 6 different tours and you're going to get this extra duck tour, right?
Uh-huh.
And he goes, and then the ducks are going to stop at a parking lot. In the parking lot, each duck is going to have 6 calves. And you're going to divide out into these calves. The calves are allowed into the state park because it's not a big group. So we're going to do this throughout the day. So we're really not breaking any rules, but we're just having to find a whole new way to do this, right?
Spreading it out.
Instead of having everybody go at once and on big buses. So he spread it out. So he hired these 6 ducks to drop us off in a parking lot and get picked up by now 36 calves, right?
Oh, my gosh.
So we get there, and he said, just don't mingle together. You know, do your thing. You know, go snorkeling. Enjoy the beautiful moment. Spread out on the beach so it doesn't look like you're one big group. And then when you're finished, you know, go back. You'll have your cab ride back, and it'll take you right back to the hotel. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, this took a huge amount of extra arranging.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how much more money, right? Because now he had to hire the ducks. He had to hire the cabs when he normally would have just had a coach. And I'm thinking, this is crazy. How is this even possible? And I went to him. I said, okay, this was a beautiful, beautiful experience. The kids had a fantastic time. Thank you for pulling through. How much extra do we owe you? You know, we'll do fundraisers. We'll sell candy bars. We'll do extra fruit sale, whatever we have to do. This was amazing. He goes, I promised you Hanama Bay. You don't owe me anything. And, you know, from that moment on, it was like, wow, you showed me something that other businesses would not do.
Right.
You know, they're all about the money. You're all about the experience. And so I said, you let me know what I can do for you. And then, you know, from then on, I've been working with them.
So that was who again?
His name is David Millwood. He owns Hawaii State Tours, and he owns several companies, but that's the big one.
So is David a native Hawaiian?
David he grew up in Hawaii, yeah. His parents, I believe his mom was Korean. I don't remember exactly, but I know he grew up in Hawaii. He lived in Atlanta for a while, but he grew up in went to school and everything in Hawaii. That's where.
So clearly,
his dad, I believe, was in the military.
So that, but clearly, that Hawaiian culture was something that he had absorbed.
Oh, big time! I mean, he is the most Hawaiian. You know, he's got a huge heart, and he's got there's just so much aloha spirit when you're around him. And that's the thing, you know. His presence on the islands is well known. You know. It's interesting because I was giving a tour. I was being a tour operator in Hawaii because I've learned an awful lot. And I was staying in a different hotel from the hotel I dropped off the group. And I brought the group to the hotel. I'm talking to them. I say mahalo and thank you for coming. And you know, well, I'll see you on the next tour. And the bus driver comes up to me and she goes, "How you family?" I said, "What?" She goes, "How you family?" I said, "What?" She goes, "How are you family?" She wanted to know how this white guy was, you know, because I had already talked about the culture of Hawaii and all that kind of stuff. She wanted to know how I was embraced in this. And I just told her that story. And because she wanted to know how I was actual family of Hawaii. Because she saw how the whole thing was, I was.
Like how did you.
How did you become part of the family?
Become part of the family. Yeah. Okay.
And it was a beautiful moment for me because it was like, I made it, I guess.
Right.
You know,
somehow, yeah.
I've been accepted. You know, so she wanted to know how.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, so I don't know. I haven't kept track of time here. I don't know what.
15 hours later. It's the longest podcast.
It's 7:22. I think think my kids, they may have actually left for the movie that we were supposed to go see together. Somebody bought me a ticket. They're not like, you know, sort of like at the windows going, "Hey, Dad, wrap it up." So, but I'm
sorry I took you away from your kids. You know, we're talking about
Spending
time with your kids,
yeah,
and then
here we are. Yeah, but maybe I can salvage it yet if we. But I did want to ask kind of a closing question, and that's one of advice. Now you've had, you've had countless students over the years, and you know you've performed, I'm sure, with countless others, and all of the relationships you've built, and in the work you've done in Hawaii, and so I'm sure you've given lots of advice to lots of different people, and so this is probably a hard question, but when I think about the purpose of the podcast, you know, the question for me is, what advice do you have for people who might be thinking about their own careers, whether it be I want to go and be a music educator, or I want to go and pursue my passion in the arts in some way? Maybe it's playing an instrument or singing, or you know, being an actor or performer, entertainer of some kind. But one of the things that I hope people take away from this podcast is inspiration, but also maybe a little nugget of, you know, that's going to help, you know, get me through, or, you know, that's going to shorten my learning curve, or that's a little nugget that, you know, that's going to, you know, help me with maybe a decision that I've got to make. So I know that was kind of pretty broad in terms of, you know, where to go, but you have license to take that where you'd like to, in just kind of a parting thought with our listeners.
Don't be afraid. And what that means is, in education, everybody is supposed to challenge you. You know, we always think that if it's not easy, I must not be good at it. Sometimes people go into things that they're good at, as opposed to things that they have to really work on. And if you're not good at music, or if you're not good at sports, look at where you are now and think of where you could be, because true education and true learning and true anything takes a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't have to be a huge step at once. You're not trying to climb the tallest mountain. You're taking one step at a time. And so teachers are supposed to give you challenges that are difficult. Parents are supposed to give you challenges that are difficult. Your friends should be giving you challenges that are difficult. And when you overcome that difficulty and you go, "Oh, look what I accomplished," and now you're at a plateau. And then you can go, "Oh, now I made it here and this was easy." And then you reach the next level and the next level and the next level. And I always tell my students, think about, you know, now you're in high school, even as a ninth grader. If I gave you the same music that you were playing in fifth grade, think about how easy that would be. You'd sight read it. You'd pick it up and go, "This is easy." You know, "Mary Had a Little Lamb," twinkle, twinkle, little star, right?
Yep.
And you go, "This is easy." But if I give you college level music in middle school, you're going to look at it and go, "There's no way I can play that." But if I incrementally keep making it more difficult, where you're learning new stuff every single day, eventually you're going to play that college music and you're going to go, "Look what I can do." And then when you're a professional, you're going to be the professional looking back on it and going, "I could play college music." You know, it's always where you're at and where you want to get to. And if you're not challenging yourself and you're not looking at each day as, "I'm going to live this moment and I'm going to learn as much as I possibly can, I'm going to be that sponge and I'm going to take on the challenge. I want to become a better musician. I want to become a better athlete. I want to become a better business person." Whatever it is you want to do, challenge yourself today. And how are you going to challenge yourself so that you get to that next plateau, next plateau, next plateau, so you are eventually at the best? Again, when I told the students at the day one, "This is what you did last year. How are we going to make it better next year?" If they said, "Well, we don't want to make it better," then I didn't do my job. they were always like, yeah, we got to be better than we were last year, because that's that drive, that's that that mm-hmm. thirst for being better. You know, why do we have the best athletes in the world? Why do we have the best musicians in the world? It's because they wanted to challenge themselves. They didn't wake up as the best musician in the world. They applied themselves.
Well, that's great advice. So how did you start that? It was, don't be afraid.
Don't be afraid.
Don't be afraid. So that's great advice. I'm going to share just one thing that sparked in my mind. In today's day and age, we have social media, and in particular, YouTube is a great place to go and find the best of the world at anything. And I sometimes think that kids get discouraged because they go out there and they see somebody who's at the top of their game, you know, in music, in this example, and can play a piece, you know, perfectly at the age of 6 or something silly like that.
Right.
And then they look at that and, well, I'm never going to be that good. And so that's a discouraging experience for them. I worry about that. I don't know if that's, if I'm overthinking that a little bit, but, you know, they get exposed to this complete range of abilities, because now everybody in the world is accessible to them.
Right.
And I think they don't appreciate the value that they bring in their local community and the music and the talents that they can share, because maybe they think they're not good enough.
Well, you know, whenever students would come into my office and go, we want to show you this video that we found, you know, yeah, of this band doing something, you know. And then they would go, can we do that? And I go, we can do it better. I said, we can do it, but it's already been done. Why would we do something that's already been done? You know, let's do it, but let's find a way to make it better.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure Edison, you know, when they invented something, people didn't come in and go, okay, can we invent that? He'd go, well, how can we make it better? You know, okay, we invented the phonograph. How, you know, what are we going to do with that? You know, somebody else came in and said, let's make something better. You know, so it always takes somebody thinking outside the box. You know, don't right. be afraid of taking chances. Don't be afraid of stretching your neck out. You got to take those chances or you're never going to get better. And so that's what education is all about. And I, even when I was working on my master's, the professor that was teaching us how to be administrators, because I have my master's in administration, she said, the best administrators put the right people, they make sure that they've got the right people working for them, they put them in the right positions, they give them what they need to work, they give them the time that they need to work, and then they get out of their way. They're constantly monitoring, so if they see that they need help, they can come in and offer some assistance, but pretty much they're letting them run the boat. If you think you're going to come in and you're going to run everything, then you're going to get people who are going to be afraid to do anything because they're not doing it to the way you would do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to a friend not too long ago, and I said, you know, my dad was in the military. He was in the Korean War on a ship, and one time he showed me how to sweep the kitchen. And he said, this is the way you have to do it. You know, he's used to sweeping on a ship, and you know, but he was a machinist working down in the engine. And then a couple of days later, I'm sweeping, and my mom walks in the kitchen. She goes, that's not how you do it. Well, my mom used to work in a diner, you know, and she goes, this is how you got to do it. I'm going, oh, my goodness. Okay, so there's more than one way to sweep, right?
Apparently,
so
yeah.
There's more than one way to do everything. So if you've got an administrator, if you've got a boss that always says, this is the only way it can be done because this is the way I think it should be done, you're missing creative license here.
Right, yeah.
You know, the people that work underneath you, they might be smarter than you. And maybe they'll come up with something better just because they haven't been doing it as long as you. If you give them the license to be creative, you're opening up the whole world, you know, and that's where teachers have to come in. And we always have to go, we're not always the smartest person in the room. We have to create smartness.
So I'm going to leave you with a thought, and then I'm going to ask if you're willing to take us out with another song on the uke. So the thought is that you listening to you today, I was struck with the amount of wisdom and the amount of experience that you bring, and the idea that you could have done anything with yourself, you know, as a career in life, you know, the talent that you have, that wisdom, the charisma, the passion could have taken you anywhere, and you chose to be an educator. And I think it's just an absolutely wonderful gift of self that you've given to our community, that you made that choice. It wasn't the sexy choice per se. It wasn't the one that led to wealth and riches and fame, but it certainly had an impact on a great number of people, and for that, mahalo.
Mahalo. My my mother said, take care of the children. As a child, I would play in the valley. We would camp by the river on the shore. My mother made the earth my playground. There were so many wonders to explore. As the sun would shine, my whole world seemed divine. As I watched the eagle soar, as the sun would shine, my whole world seemed divine. As I watched the eagle soar, as we'd walk through the old oak trees, feeling sunlight and the cool breeze, my mother would sing this song as we would stroll along. Keep with you all these memories in your mind. Please leave no trace behind. Keep with you all these memories in your mind. Leave no trace behind. Many years have passed, but my memories hold fast as I walk my children through these trees. As we stroll along, we sing my mother's song, feeling sunlight and the cool breeze. Keep with you all these memories in your mind. Please leave no trace behind. Keep with you all these memories in your mind. Leave no trace behind. When my mother died and I left her bedside, we went to the valley where we played. I promised her no markers, no wooden cross or grave, so we just walked as we sang. Keep with you all these memories in your mind. Please leave no trace behind. leave no trace behind.
That was great. I don't know about you, but I have this feeling like we did something
tonight. I like it.
Like, this was neat.
Very
neat. This was an experience. And I hope that recording comes out as good as it did in my mind. I was very focused on mixing that.
Yeah.
So we've got something solid. But did you, is that something you wrote or?
Yeah.
It was beautiful.
Thanks. Yeah. I wrote it. We did it at Mile Music.
Yeah. No, it was beautiful.
Just record this last chord one more time because I don't think it came out right. Ready? Right. You can edit it in.
All right, we got it.
You just put it over the top of the other one.
Right,
better.
Yeah. I've done that and it usually doesn't work well. So, all right, Greg. Thank you so much for coming. Mahalo. Oh, hey, one more thing. We'd love it if you followed us on social. Amperitif on Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, and Pinterest. And Amperitif Podcast on Instagram.